This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Your number is 877-217-5757. And we begin our show today with a fascinating young man, Dante Stewart, a fellow who played college football a decade or so ago at Clemson University, one of the great powers in American collegiate football, and an award-winning writer, speaker, and author of Shoutin' in the Fire. It was named by the Georgia Writers Association. He was the Georgia Writer of the Year, and he is a personality and a pundit and a writer to watch in the years to come. Good morning to you, Dante.
Hey, great to be with you, brother.
Nice to talk with you. Well, what compelled me to call you and for us to get together, hopefully for the first of a few times, about your work is the essay you wrote that went viral in the New York Times about Herschel Walker as he was running for U.S. Senate in Georgia, and of course a football icon attached to what is now the greatest power in American college football, the Georgia Bulldogs, two straight national titles. But he, beyond his football prowess, did not seem to be ready for prime time, and he did lose, albeit close, to Raphael Warnock, who, whether you like him or not, Warnock is an exceptional man. He speaks well, he thinks clearly, and he expresses himself much better than does Herschel Walker on the issues of the day, yet it was a close race. And you believe there are all kinds of sociological issues at play. What are some of them that were most prominent in that race?
Yeah, so first of all, thank you for having me on. I do count it a great pleasure and a gift to be able to share some time with you this morning. I think for me, one of the main things that stood out to me was the ways in which, you know, someone like Herschel Walker did not represent many of the issues or the concerns that many Black people were concerned about, especially in this present moment, particularly in Georgia. When we think about like Black political issues, I want to be clear that there is no quote unquote, you know, one stream of Black political thought or intellectual thought or political kind of issues. There are traditions of the way the Black people show up in public that deserves critical attention that I thought that, you know, the great Senator, Reverend Dr. Raphael Warnock, represented better than Herschel Walker did. And we can think about, you know, oftentimes the symbols of the symbols that people uphold kind of represents the politics that kind of undergird the programs that people embody or the ideas that people embody. And when we look at Senator Warnock and Herschel Walker, they represented different symbols for very different demographics. We think about Herschel Walker, it's very clear that he was, as many did back in the day with football, he was the poster child of the Republican Party, someone who they thought could simply show up and get Black people on their side just simply because he was a Black man with a football, et cetera, et cetera. And so that was disturbing, particularly what he represented. But I think the deeper disturbance was this idea that just because he was Black and this and that, that we would just simply follow suit behind him. And this really shows the ways in which, you know, this shows the ways in which many Republicans or conservatives have oftentimes thought about, you know, Black athletic, charismatic people, that they were just simply tools or performers for ideas and politics that oftentimes didn't serve us.
The guest is Dante Stewart, a fascinating man who has a pedigree that includes a stint as a college football player, defensive back at Clemson University, also one of the great powers in America, but now a prominent writer, and he has a master's in theology from one of the fine universities in our country, Emory. And in his essay in the New York Times, here is a sampling of how he gave some hot words about a sensitive topic. Mr. Walker, writes Dante, is part of a long tradition of Black people willing to distance themselves from the humanity and dreams of their community in exchange for white praise and white power. Black people betraying Black people has a legacy stretching from the plantation to today. Mr. Walker has willingly, as he did in the NFL, taken the handoff from the likes of Mr. Trump, Ron DeSantis, and Lindsey Graham, shucked and juked and jived all over black people's real needs just to hit the end zone and win at the white man's game. Now, those are strong words, and I have a feeling you had to know they were going to elicit a response. What kind of response have you received?
Yeah, well, I mean, it depends on the demographic, who the context, who read them. I think, people actually caught more, really, I faced more backlash from my ideas on white ingratitude than I did about, you know, the ways that Herschel Walker was pandering to white folks and their game, their political game. And let me be clear, when I say white people, when I talk about whiteness, I'm talking about this system, this long historical system whereby, as the great Eddie Glaude would say, where white people are valued more, their desires, their dreams, their values, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He calls it the value gap, where you know, in this moment, like racial resentment is called economic resentment, rather than to call it what it is. And it's a long, historical, enduring legacy of white supremacy where many white people in this country want to keep the country white and Christian, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that response to that line, to those lines, I mean, some people gave me backlash. Some people praised it. And I think at the heart of the backlash that I received, I think a lot of it had to deal with, you know, people having to face what the symbol of Herschel Walker actually means for them, to having to actually deal with what those lines actually mean. That so many Georgians, as I went to the polls during that moment, that so many Georgians, particularly white Georgians, stood behind Herschel Walker, not just simply at the beginning, but also at the runoff, you know, declares is more of an indictment, really, on the politics of a certain demographic of this country, rather than just simply the kind of political kind of ideas Herschel Walker is embodying himself. So we think about, okay, we can think about like police brutality, or we can think about, you know, ongoing ecological destruction, ongoing economic disinheritance, and political disenfranchisement. All of these things are bad in and of themselves, but they're also reflections of a segment of this population who continues to want to hold on to power and hold on to their innocence.
877-217-5757 is your number for Dante Stewart. Kevin in North Baton Rouge, we begin with you, Kevin. Good morning, sir.
Yes, sir. I want to say...
Turn your radio down, Kevin. Turn your radio down, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, yeah, they think black people think like deplorables are going to vote for anybody who just go for. If Joe Burrow came and ran for governor in Louisiana, do you think he'll win? Yes, he will, just because he was an athlete.
Well, and he's also a white guy who's good looking and well spoken, and he went to LSU. So yeah, he would win. He would win, no doubt about it. He'd be the governor.
Don't have no political experience.
Well, but that's a point. Did Herschel's appeal, thank you, Kevin, did Herschel's appeal go beyond the fact that he was a black Republican, but he also was a Heisman Trophy winner, and he led Georgia to the national championship in 1980. He not only was a football player, he was one of the greats of all time. Dante, what do you think?
Yeah. I think that was the case. I think. He, you know, it's what he represents, you know, and I think to the Joe Burrow point, I mean, possibly we could say that he could win in that situation, because, you know, we think about politics just isn't the individual kind of voting of the people, but it's also systems at work here. And it's back to those symbols, you know, it's, you know, Americans love their symbols. And I'm not saying that all American symbols are bad. It just is what it is. We as human beings, you know, all the way back to antiquity, you know, we love symbols. Symbols give us meaning. It gives us a sense of identity, gives us a sense of tradition. But more than anything, many symbols give us a sense of power and a sense of collective power. And so to get around these kind of powerful symbols continues to kind of give people this kind of elevated idea of who they are. You know, I think Herschel Walker represented that. Yes, it was very much so for him.
Mm-hmm. And I must say that I think if he ran as a Democrat or as a Republican in this state, Shaquille O'Neal right now could be elected governor. If he got in the race right now, he could win. And it has something to do with the fact that he's a larger-than-life personality. He's a national and international icon now. So there are all kinds of issues at play here. But Herschel was chosen, I think, specifically, Dante, to run against Raphael Warnock, the Republican Party in Georgia, and Donald Trump. They wanted a black Republican to go against a black Democrat. They thought that would win, and it almost did, but it didn't.
Oh, 100, yeah, and this is a long story tradition, and I think this is, we have to be mindful that, like, we could think that this is like a new thing, but like this has long been a playbook.
Okay, we do have to take a break. We will be back with Dante Stewart for another segment after this brief timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is the number if you desire to get in under the wire with Dante Stewart. Another segment with this gentleman who is a sociologist, a graduate of Clemson University, where he played college football and now is a prominent writer. And his words have appeared in many places, including the New York Times. And a few of his essays have gone viral, the last being What White Voters See in Herschel Walker. Mike in Villa Del Rey, please be brief. You're on with Dante. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Jim. Mr. Stewart, I'll try to be as brief as possible, but I would say that, and I followed Herschel Walker through this election, that he may have felt that he owed Donald Trump one for early in his career, and his concession speech, I had to give him credit for that. He's kind of like telling Donald Trump, hey, the gig's up.
All right. He did make a gracious concession speech, but I think Donald Trump owes Herschel Walker far more than Herschel owes him. Dante, your thoughts about the mingling of Mr. Walker and former President Trump?
Yeah. Many people have reported on this kind of long relationship. But I want to, the main point I think is important here, beyond who owes what or when or where or why, is the question I think we need to be asking, particularly in relation to someone like a Donald Trump and a Herschel Walker, or what they represent, particularly, you know, a very powerful white man in America and a very powerful black man in America. Why is their relationship so transactional, and why is so much of politics transactional, and why do we suggest that, okay, this person owes this person that, this person owes this person that? I think that's a very, I think this is one of the struggles in American politics now that I think Ezra Klein of the New York Times have brilliantly made in this book on politics, that our politics in this country has become ungovernable because for many people, we think in that framework, that politics is transactional rather than being transformational. Mm-hmm. And thinking about what can we do for the least of these, not in what we do for one another. And I'm talking to, you know, as a progressive, I'm talking about us as well. You know, not what can we do for one another, or what can we do to one up one another, but what can we do to change this country for as many people as possible and get out of these politics that simply is about, you know, this kind of quid pro quo or zero-sum game politics. If we keep thinking like that, and I think that relationship between Herschel Walker and Donald Trump is extremely problematic and endemic of the kind of white supremacist, racist, political framework we are in. But I think the larger question is why in this political framework and in these moments do we have to settle for thinking about transactional politics rather than politics that actually change the country?
Well, a listener, this is Tom on Bluebonnet. He asks about the fact that whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, there are extremely few black people in the U.S. Senate. There are 100 members, and I'm counting. There's Raphael Warnock. There's Tim Scott, a Republican in South Carolina. There's Cory Booker in New Jersey. Is that it? Three of out of 100? That's certainly not reflective of the United States population, Dante.
Oh, indeed. And I think we got to also talk about, you know, black women and LGBTQ. We got to broaden, you know, that framework as well. And I think this is one of the points of American politics that was exacerbated in 2020 with the deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery. Many people settled for simply representational politics that, okay, hey, if we can get these people in a room, if we can get them into this environment, then by osmosis or whatnot, that things will simply change. And now 3 years later from that moment, I can't even believe it's 3 years now, but 3 years later from that moment, we see the limitations of simply thinking about representational politics. We can't just think about like, okay, how like getting just meeting this kind of quota of getting these people here to represent us. But we have to actually empower those who actually are put in positions and political positions. We have to think about like, how do we change, you know, the power that other people have. So back to a few years ago when President Obama was elected and, you know, many conservatives got together and was like, yo, we're not going to let him do anything politically. That just should not be the case, that a certain segment of the population should be able to exercise that much power. So, yes, let's talk about like how little member, how little representation we have. But we also have to talk about like, yo, we need more representation and we need more political power. And that's one of the things that Martin Luther King, that as we're coming up to Martin Luther King Day, that Martin Luther King was clear about in Where Do We Go From Here, which would be his last book. We can't just think about, you know, re-educating our racial ignorance, but we gotta infuse, you know, representation with actual power to.
All right, Carol in Jefferson Terrace. Carol, you're on with Dante Stewart. Good morning. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Yes. All my life, the racist white man has loved a brown-nosed and black man. But why has there not been any comparisons to Uncle Tom's Cabin? Is that dead now or what? Thank you.
All right, he's reaching way back for that, but. Dante, you want to respond?
Well, yeah, I have to be honest. I would feel more better at responding if I had a real good grasp on the literature of Uncle Tom's Cabin. But I can speak to Uncle Tom as a kind of, you know, as a kind of political kind of symbol or whatnot. I think for many of us, you know, that symbol is a workable symbol, but I don't think that. I think we're thinking more about like, okay, we got to be careful about how we characterize people. There are better ways to criticize people's politics rather than attacking or denigrating their personhood, especially if they're black, especially if they're marginalized. I don't care who they are. That's why in my article, I was very careful about how I talked about Herschel Walker. I wanted to talk about the ways he pandered to white people, but I also want to be careful to at least, you know, seeing the dignity in the other person as much as I can while also, you know, criticizing their politics and things like that. So I think there are better ways to talk about it. Simply reaching back for Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Dante Stewart is the author of Shouting in the Fire, an American Epistle. And this essay that appeared in the New York Times about a year and a few months ago starts this way: How I Learned That Jesus Is Black. For years, I made my home with white people in white churches. I knew how to run and to hide and to move my body in ways that made white people feel more safe and less racist and more godly and less violent. Whether on the football field or in the pulpit, my performance gave them what they never deserved, confidence that the world was okay. I started in college at Clemson University. I played on a nationally ranked football team. Many young black athletes like me left home and quickly found ourselves around white Christians, because they were the ones who had the greatest access to us. Between Bible studies and church outings, our worlds became white. Our Jesus became a blonde-haired and blue-eyed Savior. This Jesus cared about touchdowns and Bible verses written in white letters underneath our eyes over the black paint. So you're hitting on all the all the sensitive topics: race, religion. I commend you for your bravery, Dante.
Thank you. I think in this moment we gotta, you know, have bravery. You know, I recently was reading Maya Angelou's quote, particularly about courage, and she says, "Without courage, we cannot practice any other virtue well. And I think to change the world that we live in, we have to embrace our authenticity and vulnerability, and firstly with ourselves, and have the courage to be truthful about who we were and who what we became. And I think in that honesty, that self-criticism, you know, and also that graciousness with your own self that allows you to be gracious with another person, I think in that, we can change our imagination and change the world we live in. So well, thank you.
Thank you, and we look forward to a return visit. Dante Stewart, again, the book that propelled him to national prominence is Shouting in the Fire, an American Epistle. He played football at Clemson University, a school that's won a few national titles in recent vintage. And he, of course, has some thoughts about college football that we will be calling on him to discuss at some future point. Dante, keep going, and I admire your work. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we'll be back with Aaron and Austin Nola, the two Catholic High and LSU project, the products who played in the National League Championship Series against each other. This is Jim Inkster, and we are now visiting with two stellar athletes from Baton Rouge Catholic High and from LSU, and as fate would have it, the Nola brothers faced each other in the National League Championship Series last year. They both come home every off season, and that's where they are right now, and there is an event coming next week, as in the 19th, the Red Stick Social is the place, 5 to 10 p.m. It's become an annual affair as Austin and Aaron Nola raise money for ALS. Good morning to both of you.
Morning.
Good morning.
Let's begin with you, Austin. I know you have been involved with this with your brother for some time, and it's a disease that's synonymous with one of the great baseball players of all time, Lou Gehrig. Your thoughts about the importance of raising money for this notable charity?
Yeah, Aaron was the one who kind of spearheaded it. I just followed his lead. And yeah, I mean, this disease is... It's nothing like it. I mean, people get it from all ages, and then it just deteriorates your body. I think there's always room to continue to raise money of this cause, and that's what we're trying to do. We're just trying to follow up on that and do that as best we can.
And Aaron, you take heart in the money you've raised. It's been substantial, and every year you do this now. It involves an evening of bowling, and I suspect many hundreds of your closest friends will be there come the 19th.
Yes, I hope so. It stinks the past couple of years because of COVID. We've actually had to cancel it. But the first year that we did it, it actually turned out really well, and it was a good time. And yeah, it's close to home to me because our Austin High's uncle got diagnosed years ago, and he ended up passing away from it. And that's kind of how I got into, you know, the ALS deal, and I really wanted to raise money because I know how bad of a disease it is, and how it, like Austin said, how it affects the body, and it affects anybody who has it in different ways. So it's, you know, some have it for not that long, and some have it for a lot of years, and I've met a lot of people that it's different. So you know, it's a sad thing to see, but the biggest thing that I love about meeting all of them and our uncle that had it, they're super positive, and they you know, always say they're gonna beat it, and it's something for us to take away from that. You know, we have played baseball and we have a bad day or a bad game or, you know, a bad week. It really doesn't matter because those people with ALS are, you know, they're battling a life disease, and they're positivity is off the charts, and something we can take away from that because it's a little bit more than sports.
Well, there will be an opportunity to meet both of the Nola brothers and perhaps get an autograph from Aaron and Austin. And while we have you, people may not be aware. Sometimes it's like being a prophet in your own land. And I'd like to go over a little bit of the success of both of these guys, and it has been substantial. Aaron, in the last 5 years, I believe, has pitched more innings than any pitcher in baseball. Last year, despite having an 11-13 record, his team advanced to the World Series, and Aaron had the second highest wins above replacement score of any pitcher in baseball. He's struck out the third number of highest number of hitters over the last 5 years, behind Gerrit Cole and Max Scherzer. So it's been quite a career for you. And you're now the senior member of the Phillies. You've been there 8 years. This will be your ninth year, could be the last year. Your thoughts about where your career has taken you over the last decade?
Yeah, it's gone by super quick, I tell you that. I remember being a rookie and debuting in 2015. And, you know, it's kind of weird to say that I'm one of the older guys and longest tenured player on the Phillies. But, no, it's been really, really good years. Met a lot of great people along the way. I love the organization. People in the organization are very professional. And it was awesome to get to the World Series in my first postseason this year. And it was definitely a different feeling. Winning is a different feeling in the postseason. Awesome to tell you that. And, so it's pure. So that's what we train for, and that's what we play for, is to get to that point. And, you know, unfortunately, it's taken me, you know, 7 years to do it. But, hey, everything in between and leading up to that has all been worth it.
You're only 29, and this will be your option year. So you, unless you sign a new contract in the middle of a season, you'll be a free agent. You could potentially garner one of the big free agent contracts of all time. Is that in your mindset as you approach this season?
I haven't thought about it too much. I'm just trying to, you know, stick with my same goal that I do every year, and it's to go into the season healthy and throw as many innings as possible and make every start. That's what I strive for every year, and that's what I train for. And I always believe if I can stay healthy, anything can happen. You know, even when, you know, games aren't going great, if I stay healthy, anything can turn around, and cool things can happen. And I think the biggest thing I obviously want to do this year is to get back to the World Series and win one. And I know that's Austin's goal as well. So that's the ultimate goal, is to win a World Series, and that's what I'm definitely going for.
Well, we'll talk to Austin in a moment. He's a member of the last championship LSU team. And Aaron has an opportunity. They're both on teams that have invested a lot of money in the offseason to better them, and they were the teams that represented the National League in the championship series last year. But Aaron Nola at 29, there's some speculation that this is it in Philadelphia. Do you think you might stay, will stay, or won't stay?
I'm not sure. That's their call a little bit, but we'll see. You know, I just take it 1 year at a time, and, you know, do anything, just control the things I can control. And, you know, when that time comes, and I'll, you know, make that decision.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think many thought would be a Greg Maddux-type pitcher in the majors. You relied heavily on control, won 30 games, and only lost 6 as a collegian. In the majors, you have become a power pitcher. You strike out a lot of batters. You pitch a lot of innings. What about the repertoire of your pitches? You throw a lot of different pitches now, don't you?
Right, yes. I mean, I wouldn't consider myself as a power pitcher, especially in today's game. But I think, you know, even though my strikeouts are kind of up, for obviously when I came into pro ball, I was never really a strikeout guy, I feel like. But I feel just if you control the ball and spot the ball where you want it, especially with 2 strikes, and you know, want to put the guy away when you're really ahead in the count, then you can strike him out. You don't have to throw a 98 to 100 to do that. So to try to make the ball move a little bit and just hit the spot as best as possible. And at the end of the day, it all comes down to control. It doesn't really matter how hard you throw. And Austin will tell you that. Him and, you know, all the hitters, you can throw it 105, but if it's straight and down the middle, they're gonna hit it. So I think moving the ball to both sides of the plate, up and down, and focusing on my whole repertoire and controlling every pitch. I wanted to make every pitch better every year, and just the consistency of it.
I think you're the first pitcher in 150 years to strike out more than 230 with fewer than 30 walks. You had, from that perspective, an amazing season strikeout to walk ratio. Many pitchers who throw in the mid-90s, they have trouble with control. Certainly those who throw harder, as Nolan Ryan being the prime example, really have problems with control on occasion. But Generally, it's not the loss of the strike zone that is a reason for a bad game. When do you know you have good stuff?
Fastball command is number one. When fastball command is there, then you can work your other stuff off of that. It's pretty hard when you don't really have fastball command, and you know you might have one other off-speed pitch, a guy who throws pretty much three pitches and, you know, a little cutter, fourth pitch, but you don't have it. I'll tell you that. You don't have all, you know, three, four pitches every time you go out, and you don't have them half the time you go out. So, mm-hmm. Or for me, probably not even a quarter of the time. So, that's what makes pitching fun and challenging is you're not going to have your best stuff a lot of the time. And you just got to figure out a way to get the guys out. It doesn't matter how it is, how you get them out, make the pitches when you need to, fill up the strike zone as best as possible, and just be on the attack mode. And that was kind of my biggest thing this year, is just be on the attack mode and don't ever give in.
Don't ever give in. How is it pitching in Philadelphia? Even the greatest players who have been there have commented that it's a great baseball city, perhaps the most knowledgeable fan base, but also a fan base that's unrelenting. Your thoughts about the difficult nature of taking the mound year after year in a city where they do not accept anything but victory?
It's tough. It's a tough city, obviously. But I'll tell you what, those fans that care, and at the end of the day, I'd rather have fans that care. And I do love pitching against them. In front of them. They push you. They really do, and they want to win. They want to win just as bad as we want to win, and I appreciate that. And everybody on our team appreciates that as well. And, mm-hmm. You know, especially postseason, we saw a different side of them. For myself, first time being in postseason, and gosh, it was electric out there, and it was super addicting to play in front of them and be at Citizens Bank Park, and definitely want to get back over there. But, you know, I love pitching in front of that fan base, and, you know, they'll let you know, obviously, if you're not doing your job. And at the end of the day, I like that. You know, I'd rather that.
Well, thank you, Aaron. Good luck to you. And in a moment, we're going to hear from Austin. We do have to take a break, but Austin Noah, of course, is 3.5 years older than Aaron, and he did not have the direct rise to the majors that his younger brother did. Aaron was a seventh player taken in the draft when he came out of LSU as the greatest player perhaps in the history of the school. But Austin has survived the test and is now thriving. He changed positions, and we'll hear about the transition from an infielder to a catcher, and not just a catcher, but one of the best defensive catchers in the game. Aaron, by the way, who said he was not a power pitcher, in 2021, he tied Tom Seaver's 51-year-old Major League record for 10 consecutive strikeouts in a game. Back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is producing, and last year in the National League, the Los Angeles Dodgers went 111-51. They were, in the regular season, obviously the best team in baseball, but they lost to the San Diego Padres in the playoffs, and then the Padres lost to the Phillies for the National League Championship, and then the Phillies lost to the Astros in 6 games from the World Series. But the two Nola brothers were front and center, Aaron for the Phillies as their ace, along with Zach Wheeler, and Austin with many key hits, particularly in the series, the two series leading up to the championship series against Philadelphia. He played extremely well, and he is a guy who is not an overnight sensation. He's not the big star in college that his brother was, although he did play on a championship team, and we're going to hear about that, the last World Series title team for LSU in 2009. And here, after hearing from Aaron a few moments ago, is the remarkable Austin Nola. And while we have your brother Austin, he's no slouch himself, and he is a guy who totally reinvented himself about 7 years ago. He became a catcher, and he is now regarded, along with the Phillies catcher, Real Muto, as one of the best in the business defensively, and he's not a bad offensive force either. Austin, you are the ultimate survivor. Were there times in your career when you thought you weren't going to make it to another season?
Yeah, I mean, it was sure, and I knew that I'd get to learn a position and have a lot of fun with it, because it is a fun position. and something that just it can make a better person, can really help later on, especially when catching's done. And I just kind of took it as a long-term thing. I said, I'm going to just take it slow one day at a time and see what happens. And it's brought me here today, and you know, hopefully still got a lot more left.
And you're playing on a team that has a galaxy of stars. The Padres have opened their checkbook to a large degree, and you're playing with all these multimillionaire superstars. How is that experience?
I love it. They're unbelievable guys. They're competitive. They want to win, and that just makes you better. I think you want to be next to those guys. You want to take BP. You want to be on their team. You want to see how they carry themselves. And surrounding yourself with guys like that is just always going to make you better.
And at LSU, you were on the last championship team in 2009, and that was a season I'm sure you have not forgotten.
Never. I mean, that's one of my favorite baseball memories of all time. That is, we still talk about it, and we still, you know, try to get the guys together. It's still, every time we see somebody from that 2019, we talk about it, because it was history. I mean, to win a national championship at LSU is a special thing.
And Aaron commented about the postseason. You were right there in the midst. You played against each other. You had two good series and then one that was not one I'm sure you would have wanted against the Phillies. And sometimes that's the way it happens. But you're on a team that certainly has every intention of returning. What's it look like for 2023 for you and the Padres?
Yeah, we got some really good players. And we've got some experience now in the postseason. I think we now just – we got to go out and do our jobs, which is play baseball every day and let the results take care of themselves. I know that if we just stick with the mindset that we had last year and just continue to grow up on that, we're going to be in the same position with the chance to, you know, go to the World Series and win it. And that's just all we can do is start from day one in spring training and develop those mindsets and execute them. And we'll be, and at the end, it'll all take care of itself.
Austin, who's the best pitcher you've caught and the best pitcher you've faced in the majors?
Oh, man. Shoot, the best pitcher I've caught probably is it's hard to have. We have so many good ones. I love catching Darvish. This stuff is amazing. Musgrove has got some, you know, just his will to win. And then we have Snell, his electric stuff. So overall, I mean, the most fun I probably have just calling pitches is probably Darvish, because he's got 12 of them. So it's like a, you know, playing a video game back there. What do we want to throw? So he's probably one of the more funner ones that I've got a chance to catch. Best pitcher I've faced. Oh man, there's so many good ones. I'd probably say, man, Jacob DeGrom's up there is one of the best I've ever faced.
The guy you're with isn't bad either, is he?
Who's that? Yeah, yeah. He's pretty good, but actually got hits off of him. I don't have any hits off of DeGrom.
Well, DeGrom's, he's now in the other league, and I think everybody in the National League is happy. But I recall that Cy Young race a few years ago with DeGrom and Scherzer and Aaron Nola, and it was one where you could have chosen any one of the three. But wishing each of you the best for 2023, and thanks for keeping Baton Rouge close and coming home to raise money for ALS. You're both... certainly credits to our community. Thank you, Austin and Aaron.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us on.
See you soon. All right. Hopefully they'll have outstanding seasons, and I suspect they will. Now, yesterday, about this time, Billy Nungesser officially revealed the worst-kept secret in politics, that he wasn't running for governor, at least not now and probably not this year, and the election is 9 months and 3 days away. So that leaves the Republican field in a situation in which Jeff Landry is clearly the front runner, and some thought a race between Landry and Nungesser would be particularly volatile. It probably would have been on both sides. But Billy Nungesser decided he's better off where he is, and he will be a resounding favorite to win re-election. And I played the song yesterday at Robin Dow's suggestion, from the Poppy family. It turns out it wasn't 1971. Hal and Monroe says it's 1969. Which way are you going, Billy? Which let's hear it again. That's apropos to what we're talking about.
Which way are you going, Billy? go to, which way you going, Billy? Can I go with you?
All right, so Billy's not going to the mansion, at least not this time around, it appears. Although he will probably be lieutenant governor for a third term, but Tracy at the Capitol set a better example of a Billy song, if we're talking about Billy Nungesser and what he was going through, was from 1974. And by the way, Which Way We Going, Billy, went to number two on the Billboard charts, Robin says, and this one went all the way to number one with Bo Donaldson and the Haywoods. You may remember this one. That get to number one, but it did in the year of 1974. And Bo Donaldson and the Haywoods. We've allowed our listeners to hear a couple songs that some might call bubblegum rock, and it's not everybody's taste, but it I'm told was on by another erudite listener on this date in 1963 that one of the great songs of all time was recorded by the Drifters. This was before George Benson did it. It was on Broadway, and the Drifters included some great singers who were with them for a long time, but the guy on the guitar on this song is a fellow named Phil Spector. Here we go.
They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway,
on Broadway.
They say there's always magic in the air
on Broadway.
But when you're walking down that street and you ain't had enough to eat, the glitter of
it's a young Phil Spector playing the distinctive lead guitar solo. Personnel for the Drifters: Rudy Lewis, lead vocals, Joe Newman, Ernie Royal, trumpet, Billy Butler, also Bill Suker and Everett Barksdale. Quite a group. That went to number 9 in 63, and then in 78, George Benson got to number 7 with a remake. And how about those Tulane Green Wave? They finished number 9 in the final poll. The footballers from Willow Street, they've had a long, tortured time since 1998 when they went undefeated. But they are number 9 under Willie Fritz. LSU finished 15th and 16th in the two polls, Tulane 9 in both. So congratulations to Tulane for a year to remember. Signature support for our program comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. We're back tomorrow, same time, same place. Until then, stay safe and stay tuned.